Bonazo. With no prelude at all, apart from this, this goes just straight in. Make your own music, ultimate and relative bodhicitta. Bonazo. So let's return to the word itself, bodhicitta, central to the whole of the seven-point mind training, central to Mahayana practice altogether. Bodhi. Bodhi means awakening, waking up. Citta, of course, be mind. So a mind that is awakening. We have the ultimate and relative. And both of these entail a relinquishment, a surrender, a release, a transcendence of ordinary sense of self, simply as identity, but also self in the world as we negotiate the world, move our way through the world, as we're in motion. You know? So in stillness and in motion. So to have a mind that is awakening, then the first big step in terms of kind of deep meditative experience is where the coarse mind, our psyche, with which we so strongly identify, we release it. We release it. We allow it to dissolve, to vanish, for temporarily vanish without trace, and slip into and become immersed in, non-dually, with a space of awareness that has no personality, no personhood, no center, no nucleus, no humanness. That's certainly a release of a sense of self. The whole sense of self that we construct upon the basis of this body, our personal history, our attitudes, our aspirations, our plans for the future, releasing all of that. As long as one is bound up in that, identifying with that, then you'll never achieve shamatha, right? You'll remain in that desire realm, you remain in the mystery of your psyche, closely identifying with it, and therefore closely clinging to the very source of suffering. So there's one element along the path, one milestone along the path of cultivating this mind of awakening, the mind that is awakening, is releasing the ordinary sense of self, of course the body as well. When you're in the substrate, you have no sense of being embodied at all, right? So there's one milestone. You know what the next milestone is going to be. This is where, whether you're operating under the coarse mind or the subtle mind, you really see through the illusion of there being any inherently existent individual with itself here at all, that's separate, that has boundaries, that has its own characteristics, the reified self, right? And so in that realization of the very absence of this inherently existent self, and then hand in hand with the realization of the emptiness of my mind, the subject over here, the agent over here, the observer over here, that is empty, a null set, there's a deeper sense of release. So as you might recall, for those who are well prepared, well nurtured, have cultivated their minds well for that realization, then it's experienced as the greatest of gifts, a celebration, a great enrichment, right? And for those who may have a glimmering of the same reality, the absence of that inherent existent self and mind, but not sufficiently prepared, then that same realization will be experienced as an inexpressible loss, like the loss of your most cherished possession, your very self itself. So, all the reason to prepare. Right? Bodhicitta, that is relative bodhicitta, a very good way to prepare for that. But there is something even subtler than that, and that is after you've realized the emptiness of your own self, and you come out of meditation, you maybe even went into the kind of meditative equipoise, non-dual, non-conceptual realization of emptiness, and realizing with the subtle mind, you know, when you come out of meditation, in the post-meditative state, so to speak, then although you won't be clinging to, I mean, you've come out of your psychosis, you're no longer delusional of grasping onto yourself as inherently existent. Nevertheless, as you're just making your way about the world. If somebody says, who are you? You'll give your name. And what arises to the mind will be a sense of who you are, who your parents were, where you were brought up, what your good qualities and your limitations are, and what your hopes are for the future, and maybe you even have some kind of an occupation, apart from just being an Arya Bodhisattva. But a conventional sense of self will arise. Conventional sense of self, right? As a sentient being. Quite a noble one, but nevertheless a sentient being. So not delusional. You know, that's authentic. But still identifying with that. And looking upon enlightenment as something in the future. If you've just become an Arya Bodhisattva, you think, phew. If you just follow the Sutrayana path, phew. That means I've finished with one countless eon, only two more to go. No? So the future, the fruition, Buddhahood is still in the future. But, of course, every lifetime from then on is going to be marvelous. Just kind of like a flower that just comes blooming and blooming and blooming. But in, of course, Dzogchen practice, then you release even that, even the conventional sense of self. Even that. Releasing entirely. The final vestiges of grasping. Releasing, breaking through. Even that. And so you're viewing your existence from the perspective of Rigpa. And in releasing that final, even nominal sense, I am a sentient being, with my own unique history, etc., etc. By releasing even that contrived, fully fabricated, conceptually designated, nominal, conceptually imputed sense of self, in releasing that, then you break through, and finally you know who you really are, have always been and always will be. And from that perspective, there's no reality of suffering, there's no reality of source of suffering, there's no cessation, there's no path. You never were anything other than a Buddha. So in releasing it all, you finally come to know who you really are. In releasing the identification with the psyche, the identification of being an inherently existent sentient being, a conventionally existing sentient being, then you finally recognize who you are. And as you always have been. You see your own face. That's how they say it. When you're resting in Rigpa, you see your own face. And your own face is Dhammakaya. And now you've tapped into the ultimate awakening, or one now could say awakened mind. Right? So that's one half. That's one side of it. And the other side, the relative bodhicitta. Fewer words are needed. But even on that conventional level, having this sense of one's own well-being being somewhat more important than others. You know, that subtle vestige of self-centeredness, the prioritization that simply says, me first. As Shantideva so eloquently presents in the 8th chapter, the meditation chapter, just turning that all the way around, 180 degrees. We've done this a lot now, haven't we? 180 degrees, just about face. And looking upon yourself, I mean, it's quite a leap. But in this turnabout, looking upon yourself, back upon yourself, from the other's perspective, and seeing yourself as other and the other as self. First of all, equalizing, in his classic presentation, equalizing the sense of the priority of one's own and other's well-being, seeing that which is simply obviously true, that no one individual's well-being is actually somehow more important than anybody else's, obviously including oneself. So that sense of equality with oneself and any other self, which is no preference, and just seeing, well, that, I'm just being realistic here. There's no buenismo. There's no goody-goody. There's no special piety, anything like that. Just being realistic. Come on, give me a break. My well-being no more important than anybody else's. And then the 180 degree. And what it's not is Paolo's well-being is more important than mine. And Gonzalo's more important than mine. Carmen's more important than mine. It's not this kind of self-effacement like then I must be the creepiest person in the world, the person of least value in the universe. If I go by, you know, by each sentient being and say yours is more well-being, yours is more important than mine, then so what was it that made me so terrible? It's not that. It's rather something just transparently obvious once again. And that is, if we turn the attention 360 degrees, just panoramic, and we open the heart and mind to the reality of all sentient beings, now something is just flamboyantly, radiantly, almost blindingly obvious. And that is, everyone else collectively, their well-being is infinitely more important than one's own well-being. And it's obvious. It's just math. It's just math. Arithmetic, not even math, just arithmetic. The first time His Holiness Dalai Lama, to my knowledge, actually taught Dharma in the West, because he made a trip in 1973, but he said his reason for going, and it was just to Europe, was to learn from the wise people of the West. That's why. And I don't know that he gave any teaching. I don't believe so. But he made his first trip to the West to teach in 1979, first a brief tour in Europe and then on to America, a much more elaborate tour. So I had the enormous privilege of serving as his interpreter for the very brief tour in Switzerland and Greece, just two places. And the first teaching was at our monastery in Mont Pèlerin in Switzerland. And he taught the 8 verses of Training Mind. And on that occasion, I remember so vividly, my mind was hyper alert and absolutely not relaxed during all the time of translating. There was a lot of vividness and no relaxation at all. I was petrified. But I still remember some of the things that said that kind of passed through. And that was, he said, there was a lot of people there, some thousands of people. And there was an aisle in the center. And he said, put yourself on one side of the aisle, and then just yourself alone, and look at everybody on the other side of the aisle. Okay, like maybe there's 2,000 people there. Now, you got that image? Here you are, and there they are over there. Whose well-being is more important, yours or everybody else's over here? And that was easy. And that's just in a tent, Okay, I think 2,000 people's well-being is more important than mine. If I have to sacrifice myself for 2,000, well, that's kind of obvious. Of course you do that. So that's just 2,000, but then when you go 360 degrees, then the significance of your own well-being relative to everybody else's collectively becomes like 1/infinity, right? Vanishingly small. And so now, in a very kind of different way than that wisdom track, you disappear. I mean, 1/infinity? That's such a small fraction that infinitesimally small is exactly correct. So once again, it's a complete relinquishment of the sense of self. So there it is. So coming in, this two-pronged approach, relative and ultimate. But of course, where it seems to be coming together two things, the realization of emptiness, the realization of relative bodhicitta, they're both, of course, springing from the same ground, where there's no duality, there's no differentiation, right? And that's Rigpa. Because the realization of emptiness flows spontaneously out of Rigpa. If you realize Rigpa, you don't look elsewhere for realization of emptiness, any more than if you're in a lucid dream, you need some teachings on, this Maria Elena over there, Alan, I know you're in a lucid dream, but yet I have to teach you how she's not inherently existent really over there. I say, what are you wasting your breath for? Did you forget I'm lucid? Of course I know that. Otherwise I wouldn't be lucid, right? So realization of emptiness is just implicit. I mean, it's just kind of like, of course. If you realize in Rigpa, of course you know everything is empty of inherent nature, right? But likewise, as Dujum Lingpa, Padmasambhava says so rather stridently, if you're resting in Rigpa, don't even dream of looking outside for some other technique or method for cultivating and realizing relative bodhicitta, because it's purely derivative, it comes right out of that. So you've gone to a common ground in which these were never differentiated, the relative and ultimate bodhicitta. They just flow spontaneously. That's why I think in all of these mind treasures of Dujum Lingpa, he is so really emphatic, relentlessly emphatic. There's one thing to do. There's one thing to do. And he just elaborates for 400 pages in a myriad of ways. There's one thing to do. And that is realize Rigpa. Because everything flows from that. And there's no comparable virtue anywhere to be found. Really elaborates on that. So it's all about awakening. Before coming back to the text, just one more theme. It won't take too long, I think, to elaborate on a little bit. But I've had quite a few one-on-one conversations with you folks in our meetings about lucid dreaming, dream yoga, a lot of interest. Some people are quite adept, others very interested. So wide variety, as usual, as always. So I thought I would just give a few now collectively, and also for people who are on podcasts, I don't get to meet you personally, but some of the kind of quintessential menga or upadesha from Stephen LaBerge, you know, from the modern lucid dreaming discipline, because it's so practical. So a wonderful kind of combination, which I spell out in my book, Dreaming Yourself Awake, but bringing together these very practical methods based upon modern evidence-based research, and then the deeper practices from dream yoga. And so just a few pointers. We still have a 10-day retreat, and I think a number of you have never been on a longer retreat than a 10-day retreat prior to this one. So brace yourself. We have a 10-day retreat coming up, starting today. You know, I plan to make use of every day. I'd really love it if I can maintain my 9-hour-a-day meditation schedule right until Sunday. I'd be happy with that. I'm going to do my best. I kind of feel satisfied. Okay, I got in my, you know, got in my 9 hours. Happy. You know, haven't been wasting my time. Personally, I'm not wasting my time with you. That I know. But I don't know if I'd be wasting my time personally. So, to give just a few, very effective points there. One point that I've mentioned to a number of you is if you're just starting out, you'd like to kind of step into the shallow end of the pool. And also, if you don't fall asleep so easily, I'm going to go that route. If you don't fall asleep so easily, then most important, get a good night's sleep. But as you're falling asleep, do so with a resolve, strong determination, that once you've fallen asleep, this is prospective memory or prospective mindfulness, once you've fallen asleep, when, having fallen asleep, you sense that you're just beginning to awake, to wake up, then as soon as you recognize that, you're kind of eyes maybe about to open up, you're coming to the surface, you're coming back to waking reality. As soon as you can, recognize that you are waking up. Try to recognize that before you've already awakened and your eyes are wide open and like that, and you've totally immersed yourself in the waking reality, get it as quickly as you can. Ah, I'm just waking up. And then relax. Really relax. Just hold like that. And do keep still. Keep still. Don't move a muscle. Don't open your eyes. Don't do anything. Just relax. And really relax in that whole business you've heard so many times before. And having relaxed and not moved, remaining still, then do something. So the first prospective memory is recognize when you're first awakening. That's cognitive. And the next one is doing something. And that is now that you're recognizing you're right in that in-between state, kind of awake, not quite asleep, then let your attention go back and recall, retrieve your last memory, the last image. It's likely going to be a dream. Where were you? Who were you? Was anybody else there? What were you doing? It's kind of like being reading a fascinating novel and then suddenly being interrupted, having to put the novel down, do something else, and then pick up, okay, now where was I? Oh yeah, now I remember where I am in the plot. And then you get right back into the story, right? Quite quickly. And so get back into the story. And once you've recalled that, maybe even a couple of scenes, then just relax and see if you can go right back into the dream, but go back in lucidly. It's called a waking-induced lucid dream. It's one of the easier ways to do it. It's called a waking-induced lucid dream, a WILD, WILD. So that's one method. It can be quite effective. A second method is not so much a method, it just happens. And I know it's happened to a number of you. I've had the experience. And it's called simply a dreaming-induced lucid dream. And this is where you're dreaming along, not knowing you're dreaming, so you're not lucid. And then something simply so bizarre happens that you just, the thought pops in your mind, this can't be real. This has to be a dream. It is. And so it's catalyzed by something in the dream with no preparation. I think for many people, the first lucid dream you had wasn't something that came through training. It came just because some anomaly, something really weird happened in the dream, and it was so unlikely, so far-fetched, that it really caught your attention. It just knew. There was kind of some intuitive knowing, this can't be. This can't be in the waking state. And by default, then I must be dreaming. And that's how you become lucid. So that can happen. So that's called a DILD or a dialed, D-I-L-D. And then I know some of you have experienced this. I heard one just recently, I'll put it that way, keep everybody's experience private. But the person had engaged in the trainings taught by Stephen LaBerge. And that is, you can do this throughout the course of the day. If you see anything anomalous, anything weird, out of the ordinary, then ask yourself, might I be dreaming? And you may also do a state check. So the easiest one, as I've told a number of you, is pull your nose. Just pull your nose. And I, I do. I have kind of an itchy nose, so I not uncommonly will do that. And nobody thinks twice. I mean, so people do that, you know, just kind of like that. Well, do that in the dream, you can do that anywhere. And nobody can think, what's wrong with you, you know? So it's very innocuous, doesn't catch anybody's attention. Do that, and if you're dreaming, and you give your nose a nice little yank there, it will get longer. You'll turn into Pinocchio, and your nose will elongate, because there's no cartilage in your dream nose, and so it's a lot of fun, but that'll be a sure giveaway. If you see your nose has grown to 6 inches, either you've dropped some really bad acid, or you're dreaming. And then you have to determine by context which is most likely. So that's a good way. There are other ways as well, just jumping straight up. A little bit odd if you're surrounded by other people, but if you're here, you jump straight up. Yeah. The Thai staff think we're probably already a bit weird, so if you do that, they'll think, yeah, one more weird Westerner, no problem. If you're dreaming, you'll float, or you'll drift down, or you'll just start flying off. The chances of come thunking down in a dream are really remote. Hardly ever happens, because there's no dream gravity. There's only the gravity you believe in. If you jump up, then often you just escape. You get escape velocity, and you just float. So, but to do that throughout the course of the day creates a habit. And then the way to kind of activate that habit is, as you are falling asleep, do so once again with the resolve. Tonight, while I'm dreaming, I won't know that I'm dreaming, but if I see anything really odd, I'm going to ask myself, I will adopt a critical reflexive attitude. That is, I will seriously ask, might I be dreaming? And at the beginning, I might not think so at all because it's so vivid. But if something really odd happens, I will ask myself if I'm dreaming. I'll do a state check, jump up, pull my nose, read something, take it out of line of sight, read it again. If you're dreaming, it's probably changed. 85% chance it will have changed. And that will be your mild, your mnemonic. Mnemonic meaning a memory device. Your mnemonic-induced lucid dream, a mild, and those can work as well. So then once you become lucid, find a little bit of menga, or how to say, practical instruction. Once you become lucid, especially for people who are novices in the experience of lucid dreaming, the chances are extremely high that as soon as you become lucid, you'll get so excited, you'll wake yourself right up. You know, whoopee, oh, you know, it's over. Shortest dream on record. Happened very easily. Or you may just come up a little bit and then submerge right back into non-lucidity. But mostly it's kind of the thrill of it, the euphoria, the jazz of becoming lucid, that you excite yourself so much you wake up. And you'd really rather not. You know, you can really explore the world of lucid dreaming, which is the title of Laberge's best book, in my opinion, if you can sustain the dream. And so the first thing is, see if you can remember this. You may not have heard it, or if you have, you might not have remembered it. But there's a little strategy there. The first thing is relax. The second one is be stabilize. And the third one is be vivid. Okay, try to remember that. Okay, because it's the same thing. Relax so you don't wake yourself up. And now stabilize, maintain the continuity of dream. And then you can gradually accentuate the clarity of dream, turn it into a high-definition dream and so forth. But then you can say, yeah, well, I know how to relax and how not get too excited, I wake myself up. But how do you stabilize the dream? How do you maintain the continuity of the dream so it doesn't just fade out like that, which is easy to do? And there's a very practical advice, final thing from Stephen LaBerge. And just by the way, it's lucidity.com. If you'd like to do the research, he has, I think it must be hundreds, and probably thousands of people now that he's taught, it has to be, thousands of people now over the last 20, 30 years that to whom he's taught lucid dreaming. And I think a lot of them have kind of become kind of members, or how do you say, have signed up for his lucidity.com. So he has, that's his database, because he never got any great big grants for the government or anybody else. So he does a lot of his research now by having hundreds or thousands of lucid dreamers all over the world who will report their experience, you know. So online, virtual reality and actual research. But the final point, if you like to maintain the continuity, the stability of your lucidity, then continually remain engaged with the contents of the dream. So touch something, look at something, hear something, but remain engaged. And if it starts to fade at any time, you may be either spin around, keeping your eyes wide open, which gives you a lot of visual input, and that stabilizes the dream, or just rub yourself down. Just rub yourself down. Give a lot of tactile sensations coming in, and that will stabilize your body in the dream. You know, like that. Just rub it down, and you can keep the dream going. You know, half an hour, an hour. Longest ones that Stephen knows is about a 90-minute continuous dream with a coherent story. Okay? And when you have these longer dreams, just like getting, if you're an astronomer, and how much time you do get on the telescope, because there's a lot of competition, well, the longer time you have on it, the cooler your research can be. Or in neuroscience, how long can you use the MRI? They're very expensive. How many hours can you be able to use that great big wonderful machine? So that's it. And now let's return. But there is a continuity with what I was just sharing with the where we are in the 7-point mind training, in the pledges. And as you'll note, a major part of this lucid dreaming and dream yoga, and in both traditions, just very briefly, in dream yoga practice, very strong resolve from Padmasambhava's teachings and others on dream yoga. As you're falling asleep, then make the firm resolve, tonight when I'm dreaming, I will recognize that I'm dreaming. So in principle, very very similar to Laberge's advice. So there it is. There's actually a lot of common ground and some simply very interesting differences. But the point here being that the activation, the cultivation, the development and refinement of prospective mindfulness or prospective memory, and that is remembering to note things, that's cognitive, remembering when you see this in the future, recognize it. That's prospective cognition. If I ever hold up three fingers over the rest, I'm not going to do this, but it would be this kind of thing. We have 37 minutes before dinner time. During that time, if I hold up three fingers, say, quack, quack, there's no reason for us to do this. It's silly. But you see what I'm saying, is if I'm holding up three fingers, recognize I'm holding up three fingers. I'm not just having a twitch or saying hi to a friend. I'm holding up three fingers. Recognize that. That's the first thing, right? Something has happened that wasn't happening before. You don't know when it's going to happen. But when it does, recognize it. Three fingers, right? And now that's cognitive, prospective memory to know something that occurs now and then, but not predictably, right? And then when you see it, say, quack, quack. Do something. Something silly, but do something. And that hammers it in. It's like hammering the nail and countersinking in the nail. Know it, and now do something, right? Well, that's all over the place in the practice of dream yoga and lucid dreaming. When you see an anomaly, recognize it. Now do something. Jump up. Read something. Pull your nose. Do something. So those two things, right? So that's really a very central feature. If you can't develop that, you really can't do much in the dream yoga unless they just happen to you spontaneously. So for both dream yoga as well as lucid dreaming, this prospective memory of remembering to recognize something in the future when it happens and then do something, right? Well, this is not something kind of mystical training, some mystical ability that only meditators develop. We've been using this a lot, but probably never cultivating it so much, unless it comes up in your profession. But if a spouse, let's say the woman's going off to work, the husband's doing his work at home, and he says, "Sweetie, when you come home from work about 9 hours from now, would you please buy some? We need one loaf of brown bread, a dozen eggs, and a quart of milk. Please don't forget, otherwise we really need that for dinner. I'll make dinner tonight, but we need that tonight. So please don't forget. That was one loaf of brown bread, 12 eggs, dozen eggs, and a quart of milk. Please don't forget, because otherwise I'll have to do it. It's kind of a hassle. I'm staying here. I'll make dinner." And so now the wife heads off to dinner. Off to work. Now, all of you go off to work. How many things pass through your mind? How many demands on your time? How many telephone calls, emails? How many responsibilities do you have in an 8-hour period? Probably hundreds, maybe even thousands, but an awful lot, which is occupying your attention, and it's just an ongoing flow of demands on your time and things occupying your attention. And among them, there's no brown bread, eggs, or milk. It's working, doing all you have to do. But then finally the day's over. Let's say you're a 9-to-5-er and you're getting in the car, you're driving home, and on the way home is the grocery market where you normally do your shopping. And you've been thinking about everything except for brown bread, eggs, and milk. But then you see the grocery market, and then seeing it, you're recognizing grocery market. Oh yeah, I need to buy, and then you go off and do it. And if you don't, you get scolded, right? And so that kind of thing, it's so prosaic, but we do it, on a very regular basis. Now, with that long preamble, now let's go to the pledges. A pledges, it's samaya, The term is samaya. These are pledges of the seven-point mind training, voluntarily taken on, and as I mentioned yesterday, to protect your practice, to protect your cultivation of the two bodhicittas. What are these pledges? You're probably reviewing, if you want to really fully engage in this practice, including in the whole lifestyle that's designed to support, nurture, and protect your cultivation of the two types of bodhicitta. Then if you really want to take this on, it's very likely it's probably in the morning. In the morning, you may review the pledges, right? And so let's just kind of look at the next one. What's the next pledge? Do not speak of others' limitations. Do not go harping on or, oh, this person, and then start complaining, and this person does blah, 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 okay? Do not harp on, do not talk about other people's limitations, their defects, their faults, their personality traits, the crappy things they've done. Don't talk about it. Now, I'll give commentary on that. But there's a pledge. And why? Because if you do that, that's going to actually run counter. That's going to start eroding. It's like letting a gopher into your garden and start eating the roots of your vegetables and your flowers and so forth. That's not going to help your practice. That's going to erode your practice. And which is more important, that you cultivate the two bodhicittas or you enjoy putting down other people? You have to decide which is more important. And so there it is, speaking of other people's limitations. And so there you are in the morning, sitting in a meditation cushion before a long day, many activities, obligation, demands on your time. And then you decide for yourself, is this a good pledge? Insofar as I'm prone to kind of really getting off on talking about other people's defects and so forth, would that be a good habit to break? And if you think, yeah, I mean, if this is from Atisha, he knows what he's talking about. I'd like to take that on as a pledge. I'm going to do my best. Very good. Okay, then meditation's over after a while. You go off and make breakfast. And there you are, driving off to work. There at your work. And then something comes up. And somebody really, pick it up on the internet. Maybe it's some politicians. Maybe it's some foreign leader. Maybe it's somebody at the workplace. It's, oh, you did that again. And just something, somebody screws up. Whether you know it by virtual reality, the internet, telephone, and so forth, or whether you see it, and you're feeling, and then you have a coffee break or something, and you really, oh, Carmen, good to see you. How's it going? You're all ready to start talking about it, you know, because there's a habit there. You know this guy, he says, oh, yeah, I know him. Yeah. Oh, you wouldn't believe the latest thing he's done. Are you recognizing the impulse to put somebody down? Are you recognizing that? And are you ready to implement the pledge of maybe we can find something else to talk about? Right? So that's it. That's for all the pledges. A fully ordained Buddhist monk in the Tibetan tradition has 253 of those. Right? People that take bodhisattva vows, 18 big ones, 46, 18 enormous ones, 46 big ones. Things to restrain from. Right? And it's all about prospective memory. Ethics is largely about prospective memory and acting upon it. Living up to your own ideals, your own constraints of not doing things to which you're habituated. Now, as we go through the rest of these pledges, they're quite transparent. They're not going to need much commentary. But as we see them, and then there'll be further trainings beyond that, I mean, just points, pieces of advice to be implemented throughout the course of the day. Something really practical that I did when I was a monk, and I still do as having taken the bodhisattva vows, you don't give those back, is when you're looking through a list of kind of constraints, like there's something, restrain yourself. When you're feeling the impulse, really I could put this one down, or oh, this party, that person, when you see that impulse, then you relax, release, and return. You know, relax the impetus, release it, release the impetus, and then return to the present moment, do something constructive, or just sit there. But among 253 precepts, as a monk, I knew there were some that I was just not likely to do. We're not equally prone to every vice, you know? Or among the bodhisattva, here's one of my favorite ones, among the bodhisattva precepts, there's one of them that is something to avoid. So listen up, because this might be relevant to you. But one of the bodhisattva precepts that is something, again, something, a fault, some, a defect to avoid, is do not use your psychic powers to destroy cities. Camila, especially, I want you to bear that one in mind. You know, I've heard rumors. You know, Camila the Terrible. I think she knows I'm joking. Okay, we're safe here, okay? Yeah, good. But I can just see Camila. coming into one more city, a bad city, of course, and just pulverizing it. You just have to stop that. You know? So there were some like that. I thought, I don't really have to give that one a whole lot of thought. I think I've got that one covered, you know, So I wouldn't really think about it anymore, except for to tell the anecdote that it's one I don't need to think about. But likewise here among these pledges of the seven-point mind training, some of these may be referring to habits that you're really not all that inclined to fall into. It's just not one of your habits. It's certainly possible. I doubt very much that you're going to equally be prone to all of them. But look out for those to which you're still prone. And then remember those, and then activate prospective memory. So very brief commentary on do not speak of the limitations of others. Well, limitations mean defects, bad behavior, bad attitudes, self-centeredness, arrogance, pride, greed, and so forth and so on. Do not speak of others' limitations. That means they're defects, right? Well, then if you're a medical doctor and you've just diagnosed someone and the person said, well, how is it, doc? You know, how did it go? How am I? And the doctor says, I can't tell you. I can't speak of your defects. Then you know, okay, now we've gone into cuckoo land, you know, obviously. Or if you're a psychotherapist. You're a psychotherapist and you're engaging with the person. You see they've got some really serious behavioral problems going on, attitudes that are really going to be aggravating their mental problems and so forth. Then it's your job. You know, using your own skillful means. I'm not going to give psychotherapists advice on how to do their work. I'm not a psychotherapist. But clearly, you're not just going to put on a happy smile and say, what you're doing is just all fine. I'm so proud of you. You know, that's not what they came for. And so whether a psychotherapist or a medical doctor or a good friend, let alone Dharma, but just a good friend. Let's take a trivial example. Tennis buddies. People who come together to play tennis. But if you see your friend, who's your opponent on the court, is just doing something really wrong, I mean, you can't win games that way, it's just an act of friendship to say, oh, the way you're doing the topspin, you'll never get any real velocity that way. It's going to be all looping. What you have to do is your stance has to be different, and you need to do this. You might try a double-handed backhand, but we'll give you more strength. You know, you're talking about the person's defects only to be helpful, not to put them down. They're your friends, for heaven's sakes. And likewise, golf buddies and so forth and so on. So I think you've already gotten the message. It's motivation, motivation, motivation. And it's so simple. And that is when you feel the impulse to talk about, whether directly to the person or about the person, for which there's probably a lot less justification, and you're speaking of defects, just check the motivation. And if the motivation boils down to craving, hostility, jealousy, arrogance, any of the above, contempt, that's a big one. Any of the above, if the motivation is stemming from, if the juice, the gasoline for it, that's propelling that speech is a mental affliction, then it doesn't matter whether you're a medical doctor, a psychotherapist, or a tennis buddy, don't talk. Don't talk. Just say, oh, I see where it's coming from. It's no good. It's toxic. So it doesn't matter what I'm about to say. There's no reason to speak with that motivation. It's toxic here. It's toxic there. So why don't I just not talk? Whereas if you see, and this is where the introspection really comes in, searing self-honesty, that we're not superimposing kind of a nice icing on a rotten cake. If we see with total honesty that our motivation for speaking about another person's faults, either to that person's face, is simply wishing to be helpful, and with wisdom one senses this actually could be constructive, I think this person would be receptive to what I'm about to say, then of course that's your job. You're a friend. That's what friends do, right? And even if it's speaking about the other person when that person's not there, if you see the motivation is benevolent, it's compassionate, it's virtuous, then you do it, and you see it's really meaningful speech, then sure, no problem. So this is not just a carte blanche, it's not a blind, a law, never ever speak of anybody else's defects, but it's very straightforward. If that which is motivating you is mental affliction, then don't. And if that which is motivating the speech, arousing the speech, is virtue, guided by wisdom, then, how do you say it? Make your own decision. Yeah. Speak if you find it meaningful. So I'm looking around for Susan Muir. She come back? It's rather dark. Not yet. Okay, good. That's fine. She has some questions here, and I'll respond to them later. So another one. Let's go to another one. Think nothing of the other side. Okay? Obviously, that can be interpreted in many, many ways. But what this is, regarding other sentient beings in general, especially Dharma practitioners, your Dharma friends, and most essentially, your own Dharma companions. So Dharma practitioners generally, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, and so forth, and then your own Dharma companions, those who are your Dharma friends. Maybe you're from the same Dharma center. Or maybe you're here. I mean, this little, our little transient community here, our little temporary family here. Regarding such people, sentient beings in general, Dharma practitioners a little bit more specifically, and then most specifically, your own Dharma friends. It is never appropriate to dwell on their faults. It's not so much a matter of speaking, it's a matter of thinking, dwelling upon, attending to, ruminating about other people's faults. Well, you do it, you don't do it, nobody else is going to know if it just remains inside your own mind. But there it is. If it's happening, you're going along with it, identifying with the thoughts. It's an inside job. You may have actually looked like you're meditating. So other people say, wow, serious meditator. In the meantime, internally, you're just thinking, dwelling on other people's defects and how cruddy they are. Then you're explicitly doing damage only to one person. So dwelling on other people's faults. Well, of course, once again, it's motivation. But I think we can ask ourselves, how often do we dwell on other people's faults out of compassion? Probably percentage rather low. If it's out of compassion, okay, I'm dwelling on this person has such and such a problem, and how might I help? How might I help? Well, then it's fine, of course. But if it's not that, it's just flat out looking down on them and then belaboring it, lingering there, ruminating. For the moment, what we attend to is reality, making it real. So when we think of that person, the person is kind of just smeared with a gel of our ruminations. One lama, who was it? I think it was Dodogchen, another 19th to 20th century Dzogchen master. He said it's like being a skunk and walking into a room and spraying and turning around and saying, "You all stink." Easy to do. And so lingering that, well, when we see that we're starting to go there, there's always, when it's done out of mental affliction, there's always a slope. And that is when we linger on, we dwell on other people's behavioral defects, attitude defects, their priorities, their values, etc., just their defects in general, there's generally a slope. And that is, compared to me, you suck. I'm looking down. There's some way that I'm looking from a heightened level. Thank goodness I'm not like you. You know? Okay. And so this is actually a little bit of boosting one's own sense of self-worth. That, well, I may be pretty cruddy, but at least I'm better than you. You know? And then I linger there, and then I'm feeling, yeah, I'm really not that bad. When I'm alone, I feel pretty bad, but now that I see where you are, then I feel a little bit better. Well, you can see this is just toxic, 360 degrees in all directions. This is all toxic. It's reifying the sense of I am superior. I am in a position to make a sound judgment on you as an individual, and I find you inferior. And then we've reified that person, locked him into a box. You're in the inferior box. I'm in the superior box. And I feel pretty comfortable with that. I want to give you some advice as soon as I see you. So it's all the way toxic. So better not do it. And then it's not only that it's not helpful, that it's injurious, it's going to really be like acid thrown on these little gentle sprouts of your relative and ultimate bodhicitta. As if that's not enough, I've raised the issue of black box. Remember black box? As in the whole universe being a black box? That we can't see beyond the veil of appearances, we can't know what's there prior to and independent of all measurements. As soon as we look, we conduct a scientific measurement, all that's arising, always in every case, always everywhere for everybody at all times, is always arising relative to what you're measuring and the system of measuring, right? It's always true. You never get to jump the fence and see what was there just before the measurement, because once again, you'll get something relative to your measurement, right? Whether you're viewing from the coarse mind, whether you're viewing from the subtle mind, the substrate consciousness, or whether you're viewing from Rigpa, it's always entangled. Even Rigpa doesn't see things independent of Rigpa. Even Buddha mind doesn't see things independent of Buddha mind. So if a Buddha can't do it, then the chances of our doing it, well, I think we can say that, okay, that's zero, right? And so here we are attending to other people's minds. As people who are not clairvoyant, we cannot simply read other people's minds. And so what are we seeing? We're seeing behavior. Or if you're a neuroscientist, maybe you can also see neurocorrelates. There's an awful lot, just a real brief footnote here. I just saw it, I think it was just yesterday. At last, we can read people's minds. It's by one journalist that she just drives me bonkers. She is so uncritically materialistic. And she's writing for a major journal, I think. I know it's coming. I see her name and say, okay, what stupid thing do you have to say today? Thank you, you fulfilled my expectations. And I'm not mentioning her name, but I think it's perfectly legitimate. You'll have no idea. I didn't say the journal or the person. I'm not picking on a person. It doesn't matter who it is. But I think it's good to be aware of this in the media, that it's just so much gunk out there, especially for the mind and brain. So what this person was reporting on was some very good science, where they're able to tell when a person is thinking about numbers by having a lot of questionnaires, doing this thing, and then they answer and then check correlate, answer and check correlate, answer and check correlate, get a big database of the person reporting from first-person experience, and then finding what were the patterns of neural activity when the person was thinking about numbers, and they find there was a certain pattern there. And then they can say, when it was quite rigorous, quite robust correlation, then even when the person isn't reporting, I'm thinking about numbers, by monitoring the brain, they can know that the person was thinking about numbers. Now that's good science. And how does it get interpreted? On the front, the headline for the article, scientists can now read people's minds. Not one scientist said that. They say, we don't know what they're thinking about numbers. We don't know what number they're thinking about. We have no idea about the content. We simply know generically, within the class of thinking, they're thinking about numbers. And we think maybe this will advance and slowly we'll know more about the kinds of things they're thinking. But then we have this. So they're not reading people's minds. They've recognized a neurocorrelate based upon an awful lot of first-person reporting. And of course, if the people reporting were being dishonest, if they said, I'm so sick and tired of these neuroscientists being such know-it-alls, I'm going to give them dishonest answers every single time. Yes, I'm thinking about numbers. And actually, I'm thinking about lilacs. Yes, I'm thinking about numbers. I'm thinking about what an idiot you are. And so, you know, if they give them false information based upon first person, then the neuroscientist has nothing. In other words, for the neuroscientist to make valid correlations between brain activity and first person experience, the person has to be honest. How do they know whether they're being honest? Do another brain study? So sooner or later, it has to be based on somebody's faith. I just paid you $10 an hour. You're going to tell me the truth, right? Please? All right. That was a tangent. Finished. But for most of us, we don't read other people's minds, whether you can see their brain scan or their EEG, but what we can see is their behavior. Very few of us are looking at each other's brains. And so we're seeing behavior. Now, if behavior were mental states, then we can say, okay, I know what you're thinking. I know what your motivation is. I know what your desires are. I know what's going on in your mind, because your behavior and your mind being the same thing. But of course, that's not true. Never has been true, whatever the behaviors say about mental states being behavior. It's just one more form of idiocy. And so what we see is behavior. Robots can display behavior, and they do. Characters in a video game display behavior, and they do, right? People you encounter in a dream display behavior, and they do, right? An unpredictable behavior. Even in a lucid dream, they're not all your just puppets. Now that you become lucid, they don't just do exactly what you expect. People in even a lucid dream, let alone a non-lucid dream, display unpredictable behavior. You don't know what's coming up. Otherwise, it'd be quite boring, for one thing, but it's not. Lucid dreams are never boring. So whether in a dream, whether it's a robot, whether it's a character in a video game, whether it's a character in a movie, or whether it's characters that we meet in daily life, what we're seeing is behavior, or the appearance of behavior. Is appearance of behavior of a person who is clearly, by clothing and by physical appearance, is clearly from the Near East, and is passing through customs at JFK Airport in New York City, and displaying a certain type of behavior. Maybe nervous. Nervous, because he knows he's 30 years old. He's from Pakistan. He's wearing a turban. And he's passing into America. He's trying to get into America. And he's nervous because he knows there's an awful lot of, you know, classifying that goes on. So he's nervous. What'll they do? Might they falsely accuse me of something? And so he's nervous. Why is he nervous? Paul Ekman is so savvy about this point because it's his profession. He's one of the best people in the world to recognize when people are lying. Okay? And reading facial expressions, body language, and all of that. But what Paul, being a superb scientist and knowing the limitations of his very sophisticated discipline, the science of affective psychology, he says, what you know is they're nervous. If you see, you can see signs that are very strongly indicative of a person being nervous, anxious, afraid. That you can draw a very strong inference. Now, where are you totally in the dark? What are you nervous about? Because you're carrying a dissembled machine gun in your suitcase, scattered among different pieces, a camouflage, so hopefully you can get it in and nobody will know. Is that why you're nervous? Are you carrying drugs? Is that why you're nervous? Are you coming here to blow up a building? Is that why you're nervous? Or are you nervous simply because you're Pakistani trying to get into America and you're a young man wearing a turban? Why are you nervous? You don't have a clue. You've got a black box there. It's one more black box. What you're seeing on the outside is an expression of what's inside, but what's inside is invisible, and you have no way of getting your finger in there and pulling it out. All you get is the behavior, which is an effect. But if you never see the cause, you cannot infer the cause on the basis of the effect if you never ever see the cause and the manner in which it's producing effect. It's a black box. In other words, you're in the dark. And that's for a nervous Pakistani trying to get into the country. Right? Well, as with a Pakistani passing through customs, likewise with your spouse. I've experienced this. I've been married for 24 years. I can see that the spouse, my wife, is feeling perhaps edgy or something coming up. And the question comes, did I do something? Is it me? Is it not me? Did I do something while I was sleeping? Yesterday? Am I aware of it? Is this about me at all? Don't know. You have to ask. And in my wife's case, said, never mind, not your business. Give it a rest. Chill. I don't want to talk about it. And often, I just said, okay, fine. Then it remains a mystery. And I never find out. And live with it. So there it is, whether it's spouse, your children, people at work, etc. It is ever so easy to assume that on the basis of this behavior, you must be thinking this. You must have this attitude. There must be something going on. And why? What's our basis? Since we never see their minds, their thoughts, their dreams, aspirations, their intentions, their memories, we don't see those. So we are artists. As we describe other people's personalities, what goes on in their minds, we are artists. Sometimes Picasso, sheer impressionism, representing nothing. But then what's our palette? So we're artists, like a painter. What's our palette? What is our palette as we're about to paint, describe another person's personality, what goes on in their mind, what kind of attitudes, values, and so forth and so on that they have psychologically, interiorly. As we paint them in our own minds, as we paint them, as we describe them to others, what kind of a person is this? And then we say, oh, I'll tell you. And then off we go. We are artists, but every color in our palette consists of, when we're talking about mental qualities, every single color, I think I can guarantee it, every single color is colors from our own minds. Because that's the only one that we know firsthand. And unless you're a Buddha, if you're a Buddha, then you know everything from hell realms up to Buddhahood. That means you've got the fullest palette of anybody. You know full bandwidth. All six realms of existence, the most awful to the most sublime, you see the whole bandwidth. Everything is imaginable. Everything is knowable, as you've seen the whole thing. You've had experiences in all six realms of existence, and you've also had experience outside of the whole realm of samsara. If you're a Buddha, you're in good shape. But if you're not, an arhat can't imagine being a Buddha. A person who's a stream enterer can't imagine being an arhat. A person who's an ordinary being can't imagine a stream enterer. A person who's not a bodhisattva can't imagine being a bodhisattva. A person who has no renunciation at all cannot imagine a person having a renunciation. A person who's never really experienced deep compassion cannot imagine deep compassion. A person who in this lifetime has never experienced rage, just like ferocious rage, can't imagine rage. We're always painting from our own palette. We're always painting versions of ourselves, inspired by fictions, reality-based fictions. This story is based on true events. And you have no idea whether it's 5% true events and 95% fiction, or 95% true events and 5% interpretation, or they were really lying and it's 0 true events, total fiction. How do you know? How do you know? So this phrase, judge not that ye be not judged, it crops up everywhere in wisdom traditions. You're on thin ice. As soon as you start talking about people and their qualities, their internal qualities, you might just want to reflect that you're describing yourself. You're describing what you actually know and imputing it on others. And if they are experiencing states of consciousness, motivations, desires, attitudes that you've never experienced, you'll never get them right. So one can ask, well, you know, what is it called? Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. How well can a man really understand what it's like to be a woman? If you can't remember being a woman in a past life, it can be limited. Of course, vice versa. So there's a lot of wisdom here. Think nothing of the other side and consider the limitations of the black box and the underdetermination. And that is, the underdetermination means you may see a lot of evidence indicative of a certain type of attitude, motivation, and so forth and so on. You may feel, if you need to draw judgment, like if you're an employer and you see one of your employees behaving in a certain way, maybe showing a lot of sexism, maybe a lot of dismissal, rude behavior, inappropriate behavior towards the opposite gender. That may be coming out of bodhicitta, but the chance is probably not. Chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. It's probably coming because this person doesn't respect the opposite gender or just feels there to be utilized. If that's that person's attitude, probably not a good person to keep on. Creates disharmony in the workplace, harmful to that person as well as all the other people who are treated poorly. So you have to make a decision. It's not infallible, but we have to do our best. Right? So it's a good point. And of course, think nothing of the other side in terms of black box. Just recognize that it's not always certain. This comes especially in the, if we kind of slip over to a parallel track, in a very trusting guru-disciple relationship. And such trust may come suddenly, very, very strongly for some very good reason. It can happen. I could say, too, in terms of my relationship with His Holiness, before I ever met him, I really didn't have that much curiosity. I remember being I think I stayed overnight when I first arrived in Pathankot, the nearest railhead, nearest to Dharamsala. So I recall, I think it was then, I stayed in a really shabby little Tibetan hotel. I guess it's called a hotel, a place you can sleep. And there was a photo of the young Dalai Lama there. And he had his glasses and looked rather ordinary. And I thought, okay, that's the God King. That's him. I hope I find a real Lama when I get to Dharamsala. A real one. Meditator, sage, yogi, wise old man. He's only 36. What could he know? So I wasn't really that interested. And then it wasn't like, whoo, like that. It wasn't something enormous, but it's when I did meet him for the first time, there was just immediately, by his presence, his words, his whole way of engaging, just very deeply and quickly, a strong sense of trust came up. Trust came up. And a connection. This person really, I'd like him to be my guide. So that does happen. And other people, it can happen very strongly, very emphatically, very kind of in a very resounding kind of way. In others, it's more like simply like a friendship. Although in that regard also, I've met some people where I think we can easily be friends for life. Just meeting them the first time. Karma. Must be karma. I've met people like that. Not very commonly, but I've met, I think you probably have, some of you as well. So it does happen, but apart from those cases, friendship is something cultivated, like among just two ordinary friends, and likewise, when the guru appears as a spiritual friend, then getting to know him or her, gradually trust, the confidence may arise, may come deeper and deeper. And when it goes very deep, maybe you move right into the level of Vajrayana, guru yoga, which I discussed earlier. Then, in that context, the guru, now knowing the depth of the relationship, the depth, the robustness of your pure vision, knowing full well that you're not reifying the guru as an ordinary person and looking down on and criticizing and standing in a role of judge. Well, my guru was good yesterday, but today not so good, but I'm hoping he'll turn out better tomorrow, you know, that kind of thing. Knowing that you've just moved beyond that, you're just a much more mature practitioner, and the guru is worthy of that kind of deep trust and confidence. When that is there, a very deep, authentic, where both the guru is qualified and the disciple is ripe, then the guru has a very broad bandwidth of behavior that may be displayed, that is all skillful means. And if it's that kind of relationship, then even if the behavior is bizarre, seems highly inappropriate, wild, crazy, are you kidding me? If it's an authentic guru, it's all skillful means. And if it's a really ripe disciple, one recognizes as such, and that gives rise to a very dramatic transformation, growth, maturation, transformation, realization, breakthrough on the part of the disciple. And we see, you know, some really extraordinary stories, accounts from Tilopa to Naropa. Generally speaking, let's make this silly, if you saw me over in the kitchen there, and they actually brought in some live fish to make sure we have fresh ones, I'm almost certainly never ever do that. But if they brought in some live fish, and then you just happened to wander into the kitchen, and you saw me frying them, taking the fish from the live fish tank, putting them into a skillet, and frying them while they're still alive, what would you think, Elena, would that be cool? No. Not cool? Bo, man, she's standing in judgment to me. Well, of course not. It's, terrible. But that's what Tilopa did. He fried live fish in front of his disciple Naropa. And Naropa took that in. And rapid transformation. And when the episode was over, then Tilopa brought them back to life and put them back into the river. So if I could fry the fish and then put them back in the river, would that be okay? You don't have to answer that. It's so hypothetical that you don't need to worry about that one too much. But many other cases, I mean, these famous stories, Tilopa, Naropa, where Naropa, again, was a man of great stature. He was an accomplished, he was like president of Harvard, you know, Cambridge University. A man of great stature, an accomplished scholar, an adept, an author, a great sage. And while there in this great monastic university, recognizing the one thing he missed was very, very deep contemplative realization. So he left the institution and then went off looking for his guru, who was, turned out to be Tilopa, who looked like just a street person, just totally ordinary. I can't remember what trade he had, but it was something absolutely mundane. You know, like a plumber. It wasn't a plumber, but it was something like that. Outwardly, it just appeared totally normal. But the word was, oh, you're looking for Tilopa? Yeah, he's that guy that, you know, the cobbler or whatever. It doesn't matter what his profession was, but it was something extremely mundane. He sought him out and then recognized, okay, he's appearing, okay, he's Clark Kent, this guy's Superman. And so the relationship was, well, then Naropa went through tremendous transformation, very deep realization, became an awakened being. He did the same thing to Marpa. Marpa did the same thing to Milarepa, did outrageous things, appeared to be drunk on occasion, seemed to be harsh. I gave him really unreasonable demands, build this 9-story tower, he built it, and I said, now put every rock, I didn't want it that way, put all those rocks back where they were. He just built a 9-story tower for him. He said, I didn't want that when you dope. Put those rocks back where you found them. Bit harsh. Well, Milarepa had an awful lot of purification to do. And so he had to have a very fast learning curve to be able to purify all the negativity he'd done. So Marpa needed to be really tough. Gyatso Rinpoche, when he was there, we're out of time, but this is good. This is the final point for today. But Gyatso Rinpoche, I haven't told this story in this one, but go back to Elena. If I took one of you, if we had a nice big bonfire outside tonight, not that it's that cold, but if we did, and let's say, let's have an evening kumbaya session. We'll gather around the fire, and we'll tell Dharma stories. And you say, oh, sounds cool. And so we're all going, kumbaya. And I say, okay, now cool it. And then I pick up Carmen is maybe the smallest person here. I pick up little Carmen. I say, Carmen, and I come in and pick her up bodily and put her right down in the middle of the bonfire. What do you think, Elena, would that be okay? I mean, she's small. I could lift her. I could put her right in the middle of the bonfire. Not cool. Man, you're tough today. She's got very high standards for gurus, I guess. Gyatso Rinpoche was Carmen when he was a young tulku, when he was a young monk, about 10 years old, something like that. It was this wild, highly realized Dzogchen master. And it was at night, and they did have a bonfire. It was for light and the warmth. He had a small circle of disciples around him, giving teachings, I think, on Dzogchen. And this is Gyatso Rinpoche told me, and he told me this story. It just kind of made my jaw drop. I let it sink in, and then I went back and told him his story from my lips. And I said, did I get that right? And he said, yes, you did. So he not only told me, but he confirmed that everything I'm about to tell you is true, and it was his experience, because he was the central player, apart from this wild yogi. So the yogi's giving these teachings. And then in the middle of his Dharma talk, at night, bonfire, the monks around, and looks very romantic to me, he stands up. And I'm going to try to do the cartoon, just to get some more fun. He stands up, he looks around and said, it's time to send one of you to hell. And he comes over to pick up little Gyatso Rinpoche, and he picks him up bodily and puts him down in the middle of the bonfire. Gyatso Rinpoche, the little kid, kind of sitting there. Nothing burning. I think maybe now she's lightening up a little bit. Nothing burning, not even hot. He said it was a pleasant warmth, sitting in the middle of the bonfire. Just a pleasant warmth. And he was kind of like, whoa. Flames coming up around him. No little shish kebab tukul. No rotisserie of Buddha, of tukul. Just sitting there, kind of, whoa. And then seconds and seconds went by, and then finally one of the monks in the little congregation there kind of freaked out, and he reached in and rescued Gyatso Rinpoche and pulled him out of the fire. And when he did so, the hairs on his arm got a bit singed. It was a real fire. And Rinpoche came out, and not even his clothes were singed. Nothing. Okay? Well, generally speaking, putting children in a bonfire, call social services. For him, that was the appropriate, that was skillful means. That was skillful means. I'll tell you one, just this one's really wild. If that wasn't wild enough, the next one's wilder. This is told to me by a lama up in Portland, Oregon. That he had, no, it's actually Eugene, but Oregon, the state of Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest. I met him not long ago. He's from Tibet, spent most of his life in Tibet, recently came to the United States, has a circle of disciples there. But he said he really feels that it's important for Tibetan yogis, lamas, contemplatives, if they have cities, he feels it's really important to start displaying them. That people know that we're not just talking, that it's not just old stories from ancient times which look like wives' tales to people who are, you know, skeptical. And so he said he'd been looking in Tibet itself. He was really keeping his eyes open for, you know, among the other lamas, yogis that he knew, can any of them clearly demonstrate siddhis, paranormal abilities, slam dunk, no question about it, no hocus pocus, nothing funny going on. Can you really display a siddhi? And he said, I've met two, only two. Bear in mind, this is after the genocide of the whole civilization. But this would be in the 90s or so. And he said the first one was a lama that displayed siddhis, but I was so terrified of him, I never want to see him again. And what he told me, and bear in mind, there's no exact, when he says two, you kind of think, well, maybe we should take those two seriously. If he said, oh, yo, my friends display yogis, they might be a bit more skeptical. But I have every reason to believe this yogi was telling the truth. I think no reason why he'd lie. And so this is what he told. He said he was back there in eastern Tibet, and there was some lama, some yogi, and some guy came up to him, and he pulled out a gun and shot him 5 times. So putting a child in a bonfire and go, pow, 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 pow. Guy, 5 bullets in him, he's dead on the ground, right? Generally not the kind of thing you want your lama to do. And then he comes over and revives him. The guy's completely cured, like tilapia's fried fish. He's completely cured. He's just been shot 5 times, shot to death. The lama comes over and makes him well. And of course, the guy hops on his horse and rides away at full speed. And this llama that I knew, he said, I don't want to see that llama again. I don't want to be shot. Even if you remind me, it's kind of creepy. So that one, he said, okay, he's real, but I'm afraid of him. And then he was in Chengdu, capital of Sichuan province, just several years ago, not many years ago. And he met another llama and learned rather quickly, this llama has cities. This is the one that spent 9 years in retreat up above Samyiling in Tibet. This one has cities, and he doesn't shoot people. His city is healing people, and very clearly, obviously, slam dunk, obviously, in some way that's supernormal. And so they became friends. Really, I've seen them together because I met the Lama. And incredibly sweet. I mean, when I just see them looking at each other, the sweetness of the friendship is just like Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe, you know. I have a photo of them out in the harbor outside of Hong Kong. And just you look and say, man, there is friendship. That must be the perfection of friendship. Two wonderful lamas. One is a very good teacher, fine lama, very devoted, dedicated dharma and his students. The other one, all of the above, and he has cities. And so cheerful, so jovial. And this second one, with his 9 years in retreat, showing cities, and his cities are all about healing people. It's all about healing. That's okay. Maybe more on that later, right now, but it's dinner time. No more stories, children. Have a good night. See you tomorrow morning.